The trick, though, has been getting traction with these forms. Even though the regulations, the forms state that we can use these to defend against compensation benefits if the claimant's not forthcoming, we found it difficult to get traction with these within the longshore context. The administrative law judges have been pretty good about granting credits when these aren't completed appropriately, but we've had much more difficulty at the OWCP level. There's a specific way you can file a charge with the district director. I had one that was worth $500,000 of credit. It was a fantastic case, super duper details, but we couldn't get any traction with the district director or with any state or federal agency in trying to pursue the workers' compensation fraud. So I thought this case was important to highlight because it hopefully shows a shift in the interest of the U.S. attorney in persecuting workers' compensation fraud, prosecuting workers' compensation fraud, when these forms are not properly completed. What happened here was Collins was an electrician. He had an accident. It wasn't contested, and the adjuster started paying benefits. Along the way, the adjuster had this sense that maybe this claimant was actually working in some capacity. And what I've learned after all these years is when my adjuster has one of those spidey sense moments where they think something's wrong with that claimant, it's worth listening. It's worth questioning, but it's also worth listening because these adjusters have really good insight and good intuition as to these claimants. So what this adjuster did was she arranged for surveillance. She sent an investigator out, and this investigator started tailing this claimant, and sure enough, the claimant's driving around in an electrician's van and stopping at households for hours at a time. The investigator goes, knocks on the doors of these households after this claimant has left, and sure enough, finds out that the claimant's been providing electrician services at these residences and that the homeowners have been paying. So the investigator gets statements, signed statements from various homeowners to say, yes, they've employed the claimant as an electrician. The adjuster sends out the LS-200 form, and what does the claimant report for self-employment? Nothing. Absolutely nothing, okay? So the claimant's confronted, the criminal case is brought. Apparently once the claimant realized he was caught, he fessed up, and so his punishment was limited to 3 years of probation, and he was ordered to pay restitution. But I do think the takeaway here is prosecution can happen on the criminal side. This is a useful tool for the longshore context, and if you're working with it with a case where you have an LS-200 and you have an argument for a credit, I would keep the cite to this United States versus Collins case handy to show that this is a pretty serious issue if the claimant's not forthcoming or doesn't promptly return these forms. The next set of cases goes to who is a physician. And in the Jones case, there's actually two different benefit review board decisions. In the first time around, the benefit review board said, we think that an audiologist is more similar to a pharmacist, and the claimant does not get their choice of physician with respect to an audiologist. On the second go-around, the Benefits Review Board backtracked on the audiologist question. And in a very long opinion, going through the statutory history, going through the regulations, going through all of that analysis, the Benefits Review Board said, we now think the audiologist is more like a physician than those categories of treaters that are excluded from the definition of physician under the Act. In the Jefferson case, the question was about physical therapists. Now, where Jones was more about access to treatment and who's going to treat, the Jefferson case had more to do with compensation benefits. And it had to do with that question of whether we can cut off compensation benefits for a claimant's unreasonable refusal to treat. And here the claimant wanted to treat, but wanted to treat at one physical therapy facility, not a different one. The carrier only approved the other one. There was a question, could we cut the claimant off of benefits? And what it came down to at the end was the Benefits Review Board said a physical therapist doesn't qualify as a physician, and therefore when we look at a choice of physical therapist, the claimant doesn't get the choice, and that can be a basis for the cessation of compensation benefits. If you are dealing with a case where you're wondering whether a treater would qualify as a physician under the Act, whether for choice of who's going to treat or for the compensation benefit question, then I encourage you to go back to that second Benefits Review Board decision in Jones and read through all of that analysis. We are running into this question not so much with the Longshore cases, but with the Extension Act cases. And as Julia mentioned, my focus lately has been on the Defense Base Act cases. We are handling hosts of cases from other countries for third country nationals. We have claimants coming out of Uganda, coming out of Peru, coming out of the Balkans, coming, you know, all over the world. And we run into questions whether some of these treaters should be physicians under the act, whether it's for medical or compensation benefits. These faith healers, the traditional healers, the herbalists, the treaters like that. And so I think that Jones case is an important one to keep an eye on. I thought there was one very interesting average weekly wage case that came out within the last year, particularly interesting because both Judge Berlin out of San Francisco and the Ninth Circuit agreed that it was okay to underestimate a claimant's earning capacity when deciding average weekly wage. So that was a bit of a shocker, I thought, for both of those. But what happened in Martin versus Sundial was Martin actually had wages that we could look at on a daily basis. You know, the problem with Section 10A, Section 10B is, can we actually determine the daily rate for that particular worker? If we don't have enough data, then we cannot apply those sections and we have to look to Section 10C. Here, we knew what Martin's daily rate was. We knew that he was traditionally a five-day-a-week worker, but the question arose because he worked some overtime. So he worked 264 days instead of the 260-day multiplier that we see for 10A and for a five-day-a-week worker. And so the claimant was arguing, you need to look at my wages under 10C because otherwise you're going to underestimate them. And as I said, Judge Berlin and the Ninth Circuit both agreed to underestimate the annual earning capacity by applying 10A in that circumstance.